end of years and beginnings of years are good times to look back, to contemplate the past in terms of what can be learned, what can be avoided. Paul, in his epistle to the Corinthians, looked back upon Israel in the wilderness and described how they, some of them were in unbelief, and some of them turned to idolatry, and some of them turned to their lusts. And he says that he reminds them of these so that we would not be like them. So we can look back, and there's things to be gained from looking back. And also we can look forward and to know that God's purposes and designs are specific, that he has devoted all of his attributes to bring those purposes to pass through whatever means he has chosen, and some of those means we understand and some of the means we do not understand. But we know that he has chosen the means most appropriate and efficient for a being who is infinite in love. So that it may, we jump into the program in the middle, and we look back and we look forward, and we're finite in understanding, and it may look one way to us. But if we understand and devote ourselves to understand God's revelation of himself, we start to take another different look at things. We begin to see it as a much larger picture, designed by much wiser, a wiser mind, with a intent that we never had until we become converted. So it may look like a foreign land to the selfish, sinful mind until we realize it's not the land, and it's not the governor, it's not the government, it's not the law. It's me, O Lord, standing in the need of prayer, as the song goes. And when one devotes himself through coming to trust in God, he devotes himself to the same end as God, he begins to see things from that different set of eyes, with different light, and things begin to look entirely different. You begin to see the depths of the riches of his wisdom and knowledge, as Paul says. How he has constructed a means to the end he has in view, and that is securing the greatest good. I'd like to start off tonight by just reading you a simple paragraph from a book by Finney, which expresses something that's in my mind at times, and I want to share this with you. Is it on? And I'd just like to read this paragraph. I think it's very helpful. In the meantime, I wish to call your attention to what I regard as a settled truth, namely, that the doctrine of sanctification is so spiritual a subject that no mind will understand it that is not in a truly and highly spiritual state. No man ever understood discourses on regeneration, and especially on the evidences of regeneration and the exercises of a regenerated heart, who had not himself been regenerated. Nor will a man understand any course of reasoning on the subject of sanctification who has not experience on that subject. By this I do not mean that he may not have sufficient intellectual perception to understand some things about it. But I do mean that he will not understand the fullness with which the Bible teaches that doctrine until his spiritual perceptions are made clear and penetrating. For example, no man ever believed that Jesus was the Christ who was not born of God. It is expressly asserted in the Bible that whosoever believeth that Jesus is the Christ is born of God, and that no man can say that Jesus is the Lord but by the Holy Ghost. Now it is not intended in this passage that a man may not settle the abstract question to some extent as a matter of science and evidence respecting the divinity of Christ. But it is intended that none but a spiritual mind can have any knowledge of Christ as God. And to me it seems plain that the more spiritual any truth is, the more certainly it will be misunderstood by any but a spiritual mind. For the natural man discerneth not the things of the Spirit of God, neither can he know them, because they are spiritually discerned. The utmost that I expect to do by anything that I can say, and by any scriptures that can be quoted, with minds not in a truly spiritual state, is so far to convince their understanding as to convict their heart of being wrong, and thus to bring them to search after the true light. I found that a very interesting paragraph. In light of the fact that I remember reading this the first time, and in light of the fact of his teaching having such a powerful effect upon me, and reading of his preaching having such a powerful effect upon those whom he preached to, for him to express a limitation from his perspective of what he believed his preaching and teaching could do. That is, to those who are not in a spiritual state of mind, he believed and expressed, as I read this, that he could, through his teachings and through the scriptures, the most he could do to the intellect was to convict the heart that it was wrong and cause the heart to seek after the light. Doesn't it sound very limiting in your mind? It does to me. That I would have expected perhaps him to say, now after this happens, then I can show you the light and such and such. But I identify with that statement to some degree in this sense, that I recognize that what goes on here on Friday nights in studies together, or even with you as individuals, is not so much I answering your questions to a finality, but that I am an instrument or a means by which your thinking is stirred so that your mind will keep its attention upon the question that has been raised in your mind until you get the answer, and that you devote yourself to getting the answer. I see one of the greatest, I don't want to use the word fallacies, but the greatest weakness, one of the greatest weaknesses in having church, is that people develop a tendency to think that they're going to church gives you all the light you need because of the circumstance you're in. So you can go to church, get all the light you need, and go home and come back, and what happens between the times we're together or churches together is unimportant because those two periods of time are sufficient. Whereas, in fact, the preaching of the gospel, the preaching of the truth, is to bring that mind further in its thinking, stimulated further in the conviction to an unspiritual mind that it is all wrong and needs to find the answer. And I see this confirmed in my discussions with various individuals, where it generally is after I'm gone and they have in their studies or their time of prayer and God's providential workings and such, that they see the answer. They see the point of it. So many times that happens. It's not just me being there and here's the answer and like mathematics or something. It doesn't work like that. So, as Finney has pointed out, and I would simply reiterate, that there's as much to coming to a knowledge of the truth through your own individual pursuits after a study as there is in our time together of study. And not make any study the place where it's all going to happen, and if you're done, just go home and say, well, when I get back next week, we'll just plug in there. But all of us must have that pursuit after truth at all times. And I wanted to share that with you. Open with, would you please, to 1 Thessalonians. Does anybody have any questions from our last study that you would like to raise before we go on? It's in your mind. I'm intrigued by, and I understand the difference, the dynamics of a group as opposed to an individual. What can be done in with an individual talking and what cannot be done in a group. And I suppose we're all aware of that. That there are people in a group who have immediate questions and concerns, but believe it's not the time or the place to ask those. And the questions that often get asked are more general than apply to any individual who's asking them. So with that kind of self-inhibition, the questions that really are pertinent and on an individual's mind don't get asked. But general questions do. But one-on-one, we know better because the real questions get asked and dealt with. So groups are very limiting in just the very nature of it, and I understand that. But I don't think they need to be. But I think that takes a time to develop in a group where people believe that anything can be laid out and it's safe to do so. And I do believe that in a period of revival in a group, amongst a group of people, there is that willingness to be known for the state in which one truly is at the moment, whether it's in a state of loving God or in a state of unbelief or in a state of rebellion or whatever it is, that sinners come in and they see the honesty of people living before them, and they see the opportunity to be honest in the state that they're in as well. So I believe that it's also possible. I'd like to go through some things in 1 Thessalonians tonight. It's going to be looking at Paul, looking at the Thessalonians, and some of the things that he points out. 1 Thessalonians chapter 3. Does anybody know where Thessalonica is? The city, Thessalonica. Pat?
I believe that Sam would be today called Turkey.
No. Asia Minor, yeah, it's what would be right at the northern part of Greece today. Okay. So that's where Thessalonica was. Philippi, Thessalonica, right up there. Still, today it's in Greece. You can go to Thessaloniki, it's called today. Thessaloniki. There's two letters written to the Thessalonians. And I'm going to start off by 1 Thessalonians chapter 3 and read a couple verses here to give you a starting point. And you'll see why in a few minutes. Paul writing says, "Therefore, when we could endure it no longer, we thought it best to be left behind at Athens alone, and we sent Timothy, our brother and God's fellow worker in the gospel of Christ, to strengthen and encourage you as to your faith." Okay. Who is the we here? Paul. Excuse me? Paul. Silvanus. And Timothy were those addressing the letter. And what is another name for Silvanus? Does anyone know? Pat? Silas. It's a derivative of another form of Silas. So Paul and Silas stayed, and because they could endure no longer something, they thought it best to stay in Athens, Paul and Silas, and to send Timothy back to Thessalonica for what? For what reason? Teresa?
To encourage those in your faith.
Okay, to strengthen and encourage you, the Thessalonians, in your faith. Okay. Turn to Acts chapter 17. Acts chapter 17. Acts chapter 17 is the account of Paul in the city of Thessalonica. And we're going to read these first 9 verses because that's the account of being in that city. So we will start with Guy, and we'll go around in a circle, and each read one verse. Chapter 17 of Acts, starting with verse 1.
Now when they had traveled through Amphipolis and Apollonia, they came to Thessalonica, where there was a synagogue of the Jews.
Explaining and giving evidence that the Christ had to suffer and rise again from the dead, and saying, "This Jesus who I am proclaiming to you is the Christ."
And some of them were persuaded, and a great multitude of the devout Greeks, and not a few of the leading women, joined Paul and Silas.
But the Jews, becoming jealous and taking along some wicked men from the marketplace, formed a mob and set the city in an uproar. And coming upon the house of Jason, they were seeking to bring them out to the people.
And when they did not find them, they began dragging Jason and some brethren before the city authorities, shouting, "These men who have upset the world have come here also."
And Jason has welcomed them into his house. They are all defying Caesar's decrees, saying that there is another king, one called Jesus.
Okay.
And they stirred up the crowd and the city authorities who heard these things.
And when they had received the flesh from Jason, they
had received. Okay, here's the total account of his time in Thessalonica. 2 weeks, 3 Sabbaths. Maybe he was there a few days before and after those Sabbaths, but a total of about 3 weeks before these radical Jews pursued him and drove him out of this city as well. Now, what did Paul do in the synagogue in Thessalonica? What was his message?
That the Messiah had to suffer and die and would rise again.
Okay.
This Messiah is Jesus.
Two things. First thing, he had to prove through evidence from the scriptures using reason. Verse 2. Reasoning with them from the scriptures, explaining and giving evidence that Christ, that is the Messiah, had to suffer and rise again from the dead. And saying that this Messiah who had to suffer and die and rise again from the dead is identified in the person of Jesus. Now, that's a very interesting statement because I am very weak on where in the Old Testament it says that the Messiah had to die. Can you think of any place?
Daniel chapter 9.
The prince shall be cut off?
Be cut off.
Okay.
The term, I understand, is for capital punishment.
Okay, so there's a suggestion there that the Messiah would be cut off.
Isaiah 53,
suffering, being pierced.
For our transgressions.
Mm-hmm.
He was cut off out of the land of the living.
Out of the land of the living, all right, okay. There's two. Okay. Keep Acts chapter 17 and turn to 1 Peter, first chapter. First Peter chapter 1. Keep Acts 17 in your fingers there. 1 Peter chapter 1. And I'm going to read verses 10 and 11. Follow along as I read. Peter's writing and says, "As to this salvation, the prophets who prophesied of the grace that would come to you made careful search and inquiry, seeking to know what person or time the Spirit of Christ within them was indicating as he predicted the sufferings of Christ and the glories to follow. Peter is saying there that the prophets, as we know of the Old Testament prophets, that were prophesying of the grace to come, prophets prophesied of grace, made a diligent inquiry as to what person or time the Spirit of Christ within them was indicating. Whether it was going to be a person, and which person it was going to be, or a time that he, the Spirit of Christ, predicted the sufferings of Christ and the glories to follow. So Peter is saying that the Old Testament prophets told of the sufferings of Christ and the glories to follow of the Messiah. Okay? Now back to Acts 17. The Jews at the time of Jesus, as a group, not all, but a very small minority is excluded here, as a group, had come to view the Messiah and his coming as purely glories. They ignored or interpreted the prophecies of his sufferings as referring to the nation of Israel itself, but not to the Messiah. So they thought he was coming to be the king. Messiah was coming, it would be to be king, to sit upon the throne of David, and they ignored or misinterpreted the prophecies of his suffering. So they were constantly trying to take him by force to make him king. You know, even the disciples, as Jesus was leaving, said, you know, are you going to restore the kingdom now to Israel? The kingdom was the main thought about the Messiah, not his sufferings and death. So in Peter, as well as Paul here in Acts 17, the message was to prove to the Jews that the Messiah was to suffer and rise again from the dead and have glories to follow after that. He had to prove, first of all, the Messiah had to suffer and die before Jesus could be identified as the Messiah. Because it was known Jesus suffered and died. The claim was that he also rose again. If the Messiah was not to suffer and die, Jesus could never be identified as the Messiah. So Paul had to prove, and it says he reasoned with them, giving evidence that Christ, the Messiah. See, the term Christ is not a name of Jesus. It's a title, meaning the Messiah. Jesus is his name. We call him Jesus Christ. We have taken the term Messiah and put it with his name. But when they said Christ, they weren't referring to Jesus. They were referring to the title of Messiah. So that Christ had to suffer didn't have Jesus in mind here, just the Messiah that was to come. Now, he demonstrates that and makes the claim that this Jesus is the Messiah that was to suffer and die. Some were persuaded of that, verse 4 says. Some of the Jews were persuaded, along with a great multitude of the God-fearing Greeks. That is, there was a lot of Greeks or Gentiles called God-fearers who were permitted to attend the synagogue and participate in a lot of things, but were never permitted into the inner workings of the Jewish nation, like going up into the temple and offering sacrifices. They couldn't do that. But they were permitted to attend the synagogue, and they were called God-fearers, and they were proselytes. But they were never permitted or considered to be a full part of Israel. So a great multitude of them believed. Now verse 5 talks about the jealousy of the Jews, which resulted in driving Paul out of the city by setting up a mob and making claims that Paul did not claim, but transferring over Paul's claim that Jesus was the Messiah, which would mean king as well. Then they accused Paul of preaching a political king against the political Caesar, which is what the political authorities would have been interested in. So they drove him out of the city. So Paul was driven out, went to Berea, then on eventually down to Athens. Now back to 1 Thessalonians. Okay, Paul, Silas, and Timothy end up in Athens, and at verse chapter 3 of what we just read in 1 Thessalonians, they decided that they could endure it no longer, meaning they had no word of what had happened to those in Thessalonica after they had been driven out after preaching there for 3 weeks. So they sent Timothy to find out what had happened to them, what's going on with them. And Timothy reports back, now we have the reason why Paul wrote the letter. Paul is writing the letter after finding out what Timothy told him about the Thessalonians. Okay? Chapter 1. Paul and Silvanus and Timothy to the church of the Thessalonians and God, the Father, and the Lord Jesus Christ, grace to you and peace. We give thanks to God always for all of you, making mention of you in our prayers, constantly bearing in mind your work of faith and labor of love and steadfastness of hope in our Lord Jesus Christ in the presence of God, our God and Father. Paul learned from Timothy that they had a work of love, a work of faith, a labor of love and steadfastness of hope. And he thanked God for that. What did Paul say are the 3 things that stand? Faith, hope, and love. And the greatest is love. So they had all 3. Knowing, brethren, beloved by God, His choice of you, for our gospel did not come to you in word only, but also in power and in the Holy Spirit and with full conviction, just as you know what kind of men we proved to be among you for your sakes. For also you became imitators of us and of the Lord, having received the word in much tribulation with the joy of the Holy Spirit. They received the word in much tribulation. Paul is referring to the time when he was there and the Jews got up the mob and caused this great conflict. Great tribulation was the context in which they had received the word. But they did receive the word. Verse 7, so that you became an example to all the believers in Macedonia and Achaia, which is Greece. For the word of the Lord has sounded forth from you, not only in Macedonia and Achaia, but also in every place your faith towards God has shown forth, so that we may have no need to say anything. For they themselves report about us what kind of a reception we had with you, and how you turned to God from idols to serve a living and true God, and to wait for His Son from heaven, whom He raised from the dead, that is Jesus, who delivers us from the wrath to come. So here's Paul's statement, opening statements, his certain knowledge of their faith, hope, and love, that they believe, that their faith has been sounded out throughout the area. So this was not a hit-and-miss type of thing. This was not a faltering thing that he planted there. But the results of his preaching and their receiving the word is producing this faith, hope, and love, and a reputation among others of their faith in Christ as the Messiah. And this all came about because of Timothy's report back to Paul. Now, chapter 2, this first introductory part is very important, and there's a lot to be derived from it, but chapter 2 is what I want us to set our attention on. Paul says, for you yourselves know, brethren, that our coming to you was not in vain, but after we had already suffered and been mistreated at Philippi, what happened there? Philippi? Remember? The city of Philippi? Philippian jailer? He was beaten with rods, then thrown in jail. Remember that? Okay, great difficulty there. That's what he's referring to. That was the city he was at before he went to Thessalonica. Got thrown out of Philippi as well. Been mistreated in Philippi, as you know. We had the boldness in our God to speak to you the gospel of God amid much opposition. They knew that. Their own opposition. They knew that he had preached the gospel under those conditions. For our exhortation does not come from error or impurity or by way of deceit. Wow, what claims? What a claim. Our exhortation, that is his proclaiming of the gospel of God, does not come from error or impurity or by way of deceit. Think about that. Paul's claim that his gospel was free of error, free of impurity, and he was not presenting it in deceit. He had no ulterior motives. But just as we have been approved by God to be entrusted with the gospel, so we speak not as pleasing men, but God, who examines our hearts. Paul is laying before the Thessalonians to recall him being there and that he presented the gospel absence of error, impurity, or deceit upon his part. And calling them to bear witness to that. But just as we have been approved by God to be entrusted with the gospel, I have found that term, I think, two other times as well as here about Paul. When he says about himself that he was entrusted with the gospel. And that has stuck in my mind. Because I see that as a terminology or Paul saying something about himself that is not attributed to every believer. That Paul says he was entrusted with the gospel. I don't see that as being that everybody equally knew the gospel, but somebody designated him to go out and preach it. I see that this as God entrusting the gospel to him. Not to everybody. Not to many. But there are some whom God has chosen to be those to whom he entrusts the gospel to. Now, this does not generate an idea that there are elite who are ignorant of the gospel and must depend upon the few who know the gospel. But I believe it is very much in line with Ephesians chapter 4, where God said, or the Paul says that God has given to the church prophets and apostles and evangelists and pastors and teachers. They are being gifted particularly for the work of the ministry, for those in the church, to build them up, to develop them, to discipline them, to instruct them. And I believe in that same sense, Paul is saying that the gospel was entrusted to him. Why? Because we have been approved by God to be entrusted with the gospel. And to me, it's just the sense that God entrusted him with something that is not entrusted to everybody. And then Paul considered that entrusting an obligation to see that it was disseminated, preached everywhere possible by him, since he had been entrusted with it. But since not every believer was entrusted with it in the sense of having it to impart in such a way to impart it to others, that it put upon him the obligation to see that it was done, since not all had that responsibility. Now, since he was entrusted with the gospel, he said, so we speak not as pleasing men but God, because it was God who entrusted, not man. So he must speak as pleasing God who entrusted him with the gospel, not man, because man isn't the one that did so. And then he gives another description of himself. For we never came with flattering speech, as you know, nor with a pretext for greed. God is witness. Nor did we seek glory from men, either from you or from others, even though as apostles of Christ we might have asserted our authority. But we proved to be gentle among you, as a nursing mother tenderly cares for her own children. Paul says in verse 5, we never came with flattering speech, as you know. He calls upon them to testify from their own knowledge that he never came with flattering speech. Never came to massage their ego, talk to them about their self-esteem and all the things that might attribute and add to your self-esteem and make them feel better or flatter them in any way. Flattery was not his, his means of communication, and he calls him to bear witness to that. Then he calls to bear witness God that he didn't come with a pretext for greed. It's apparent from the scriptures that the apostles had the authority to have those to whom the gospel was preached and they believed it, they had the authority to they had the authority to depend upon those who believed the gospel for their income. And Paul talks about that in 1 Corinthians, that he had the authority as an apostle to depend upon them for his financial help, but he refused to. Rather, he worked with his hands so he wouldn't be a burden to them, meaning the financial burden. But he had the privilege and the authority as an apostle to have the believers support him, is what he's saying. So here, because he was an apostle, there is the possibility that one who had the recognized authority to have those to whom he preached support them, there's a possibility for some to use that as an occasion for greed and take great advantage of that. But he says, I call God to witness that I did not come as a pretext for greed. I did not come to you preaching and use that as a pretext to get money from you. And he says, God is my witness of that. Nor did we seek glory from men, either from you or from others. But we proved to be gentle among you as a nursing mother tenderly cares for her own children. It's what I was talking about last time, I think it was, that those who share the gospel, all believers are going to talk to others about their spiritual state, must not do it with scolding or rebukes in the terms of as the means to bring them to trust God and forsake their sin. But there must come this fond affection like a nursing mother tenderly cares for her own children. It's the love of God that brings us to repentance. It must be the love of the proclaimer of the gospel that is seen as well, and the influence that love has with the truth. And that's what Paul is attributing here. For you recall, brethren, our labor and hardship, how working night and day so as not to be a burden to any of you, we proclaim to you the gospel of God. That's the second time he's used the term gospel of God. Usually we talk about the gospel of Jesus Christ. We emphasize the gospel of Christ. And the idea is oftentimes that it's Christ. Christ is the good news because he died and turned the Father from a father of wrath to a father of love. That the death of Christ has made God the Father benevolent. He has appeased God in such a way that now he is no longer full of just wrath, but now he's benevolent. So it's the gospel of Jesus. But Paul here, as well as in the first chapter of Romans, calls it the gospel of God. Because all of God, all of the Trinity, is involved completely in bringing about the salvation for men. It is all of God being moved by love that brought about an atonement for sin and the revelation of it. So Paul is showing that it's the gospel of God, and he's referring to all of God, the Trinity. And it's not just Jesus making the Father benevolent. It's the good news of God. That God himself so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son. The Father's love as well as the Son's love that was involved. Verse 10, you are witnesses, and so is God, how devoutly and uprightly and blamelessly we behaved towards you believers. Some more claims of Paul. You are witnesses, and so is God. Again, he calls God and them as witnesses, how devoutly and uprightly and blamelessly we behave towards you believers. You cannot take scriptures like this and make them compatible with interpretations of Scripture that, for example, in Philippians, people say that when Paul says in Philippians, "I am the chiefest of sinners," he's talking about his current state of being in that state when he wrote Philippians as chief of sinners, in the sense that he is currently sinning so much that he is a chief of all sinners. When he says to the Thessalonians how devoutly and uprightly and blamelessly we behaved towards you believers. This cannot be compatible at all with the idea that Paul, throughout his life, as a believer, continued to live in sin, was not a good example, but was blameful and not upright and not devoted. And Paul calls upon the Thessalonians and God to witness that he was blameless and upright and devout in his witnessing to them of the gospel of God. And that's not compatible with an idea of Paul as living in sin throughout his life as a Christian. Excuse me. Now, just as you know how we were exhorting and encouraging and imploring each one of you as a father would his own children, so that you may walk in a manner worthy of the God who calls you into his own kingdom and glory. Verse 11 and verse 12. Verse 11 says Paul did something, and verse 12 tells us why he did it. What does verse 11 tell us Paul did? Hands, please. Verse 11. What did Paul do when he was there? Teresa?
He was exhorting,
imploring. What's the last one? Those three things, each one of you, as a father would his own children. By the way, there's a good verse to draw instruction from for fathers to do what to do with their children. Exhort them, encourage them, and implore them. And he says that he did it as a father to their children. So we can take from this that this would be a good verse for fathers to apply for themselves in regard to their children. This is what Paul did when he was there for just 3 weeks. Why did he do it? Verse 12. Danny? So that you may walk in a manner worthy of the God who calls you How do we know that this is why Paul did this? Teresa? Is that right? How do we know he said he did? It says, I said this. Why did I say this? I said that because. What is the grammatical construction that indicates to us this is why he did this. Danny?
When you said so that.
Okay. That. For your own reading of the scriptures, understand when you have a so that, what follows is the reason for what was said before. Sometimes you just have that. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son. Does that work the same way? It's reverse, isn't it? Is it reverse? He gave his only begotten Son, why? Let's see if we can figure this out. God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish but have everlasting life. Because of this, he did this. Because of this, this happened. Right? True? If I'm making a mistake here, correct me. God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish but have everlasting life. This produces this in order that this would happen. So you get the word that in there and you're giving a reason one way or the other between the two statements. See that? We use that thinking all the time in our thinking to identify motive. We not? Think about your life and what you do. Why did you do what you did? I did that so that. Is that not how? That's how we express things. That's what Paul is expressing. I did this so that this would come about. And that's why I did that, so this would come about. Okay, now think about, true? Okay, now this is the means by which you can identify your motives. It's infallible. Just ask yourself why you did something and you will say, if you think about it, so that such and such and such, or so that this would happen, or so that this would come to me, or whatever. What's the reason for doing something? Give me some examples. Why do you work? So that. What? Why do you support your family? See? That isn't the last answer, was it? See? Why do you come to Friday night Bible study? So that. And why? See? it's an interesting exercise in the mind to do this. Find out your motives. Paul did this. He exhorted them, implored them, and encouraged them. His motive was that they would walk in a manner worthy of the God who calls them. I'm going to go through an exercise that springs off of a discussion I had with Greg earlier this week, or within the last week. And that is the end. We've discussed this before, but I want to use this as an opportunity to discuss it again tonight. And if you want to give me any input from our discussion, feel free to do that, to reconstruct it somewhat. What end does the law, the moral law, command? Guy?
Love God supremely.
Okay, the law commands that we love God supremely. And what else?
And neighbor as ourselves.
And our neighbor. Okay. But we know that that's not self-defining. We know we don't automatically have an idea. Everybody doesn't have the same idea of what love is. True? So that has to be defined. We know it cannot be feelings, because you can't command your feelings. They're involuntary. Can't command us to have a certain desire, because those are involuntary. So it has to be an act of the will, which is a commitment to promote the good of another for its own sake. Now, I'm aware that in my discussions with various ones in here, all of you at different times, that it is easier to shorten our terminology for the sake of discussion. So in our discussions about love, we talk about loving God supremely, rather than saying, love God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength, which is what really the command says. But for the sake of discussion, we shorten it down to love God supremely and our neighbor as ourselves. Then when we define love, we say it's the commitment to promote the well-being or good of another for its own sake. But in our interest of shortening time, we often say it's the commitment to promote the good of another. And we often leave off for its own sake, which is an absolute necessary part of our understanding. But for the sake of time, we often drop it off and we just repeat back and forth, well, it's the commitment to promote the good of another. And that is a very insufficient definition. It must include for its own sake. Now, what does that mean, for its own sake? If that is to be the end for which one lives, and it is not just a good suggestion, but it's a law that one have the end in view that the law commands, to be committed to that end, and if one has an improper understanding, faulty view of the end, they may be living for an end that is not compatible with the moral law. And I want to try to stir this up in our thinking and draw it out and expand on this in our remaining time. Questions arise in this discussion when a person is under conviction and they hear of the necessity to promote God's interest supremely and their neighbors as themselves, the commitment to promote the good of God supremely and the good of my neighbor as myself for its own sake. And a person thinks about that and they get an idea of what that might mean, and they think that they're willing in their mind and their heart and their will to do so, but then they believe that they're also not doing so. And that can come from a barometer that they use. And there's lots of them. They have some kind of preconceived barometer that says to themselves, I know that if I love God with all my heart and love my neighbor as myself, such and such X would be true. As the barometer they have in their own mind, X would be true. I'm not in X, therefore I must not love my neighbor as myself. I must not love God supremely, because they are not in a state in which they would believe they would be in if they did love God supremely. One of those states is the state of one's feelings. If I love God with all my heart and love my neighbor as myself, I'm sure I would feel a certain way. And this is a prediction, by the way, because they've never been in that state, so they really have no way of knowing, but they assume or try to imagine, based on whatever thinking that they've done, that surely they must be in a certain state. I'm sure that as I gave my testimony to people, how I, being redeemed from sin and the bondage of sin, found great joy in believing. I'm sure there were people who thought, ah, when I have great joy, I'll know that I love God supremely. That would be the state to be in as a confirmation that one has passed from death to life. So this can vary with every individual projecting some kind of state of feeling that they'll be in. As the evidence that they have committed themselves to the end that God requires, the law commands. This is probably one of the biggest trip-ups as well. They believe that they will have a package of new desires given to them that they currently don't have, that will prove to them that they now love God supremely and live for the end that God requires. Not finding those feelings, those desires that they believe they ought to have if they were sanctified or if they love God supremely, then they conclude, well, I must not love God supremely. In either of these cases, the person really sets out to bring about one or two of these. Well, in doing so, what have they done? What has become their end? Okay. The mind becomes devoted to securing certain desires or feelings, not securing good for other beings. See how that can happen? Jeff?
I can see how that can happen. Okay. I can see how it could happen with a pure motive as well.
To make desires the end.
They have faulty understanding that they're fault. Is that their problem? If they've been deceived or whatever?
Well, to have a pure...
If they haven't been taught correctly, they're still held liable for what they've been taught. Even though they've been taught incorrectly, even though I don't know if you're. I can see people doing things out of a pure heart, even though it's not really the best thing to do.
I can see people who love God supremely doing things that may not be the best thing to do if somebody else was making decisions, but on the decision-making ability that they have, it's the best decision that they can make to promote God's interests. I can see that. That's not equal to a pure heart. let me back that up a minute. I can see people devoted to love God supremely making the best decision they can, even if they're ignorant. But it is different than seeking to have certain desires as the evidence that they love God supremely. Instead, the command is to love God supremely, that is, to make good to universal being the end for which one lives. If one believes that that will necessarily be accompanied by certain desires, and those desires are not there, in order to assure themselves that they have this as their end, they seek to secure those desires, they have turned away from that end. That's the point I'm trying to make on this one statement. If this is what they believe constitutes obedience or love to God, and this is not there, however they imagine their desires are to be, if they seek to make those come about, then they no longer seeking to make good come about. They're seeking to develop certain desires. This is another means I'm trying to describe of how people may deceive themselves or be diverted from, because of faulty understandings about what loving God is about, be believing that this is what must come about. Particularly if one believes that they have a view of themselves that I live by what I want. I know that I live because I move because I want certain things. So for me to love God supremely, because I'm so accustomed to living by my desires, the only thing that they can conceive of in his X unknown factor is, must be because I need to get a desire for God that's stronger than any other desires to overcome my other desires. It seems to be the most prevalent way people concoct in their thinking to try to figure out how to accomplish this. So they, and theologically this is taught very strongly, by the way, that God gives you new desires when you're born again, and therefore you overcome sin because the desire to love God and desire for holiness is stronger than the desire to sin. In fact, that school of thought makes certain desires sinful and certain desires holy, which is not true. So that's a great basis for misunderstanding and misdirection of one's minds. So feelings and thoughts preconceived of what they ought to be is how a person judges whether they love God at some stage and when they think that they're willing to love God. And they look for these desires or they look for these feelings and they're not there. And therefore, they conclude that they don't love God, which may be true, but not for the reasons that they're giving. Okay. Anybody else want to offer other reasons? Other things that people have in this preconceived thinking that would be attributed or go in the same category as feelings and desires? Greg?
Perhaps someone else is converting.
Another's experience. Yeah?
Well, if they do certain things, then they believe that they love God. If they read their Bible, if they go to Bible study, if they are regular at church, if they tithe, all the external things.
So they preconceive that these are things that constitute loving God.
Mm-hmm. And then someone who would love God.
So if this constitutes loving God, I must therefore do these things and making sure I don't leave anything out. So this one preconceives what loving God would consist of in acts, external activities. Okay. This can be detrimental to other people if copying somebody else's experience is the means to conversion. It's not. The issue is what is true, not what did I experience when I believed the truth. You know, some may experience great tranquility, others.
This is the end of side one. Side two now begins.
Preacher, because that's how that person had that wonderful experience. I need to fast like David did, because he knew the will of God after he fasted. point out other people's experience of what they did, just instead of believing the truth. So that's what some people can do. Anything else, Jeff?
It might be the other side of the coin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, when you said that desires are neither sinful or holy, you know, but the lack of I don't know what else to call it, but the sinful desires. So
a person might think if they love God supremely, certain desires would go away.
Yeah.
Okay. So they seek to have those desires to go away. Okay. So the mind may preconceive certain states that must be in the sensibilities as an evidence that one has actually conformed itself to what the law requires and what God commands and the spirit of it all. But let's look at the end. Somebody describe the end to me that the law has in view, that God has in view in commanding it, that would be in the person's mind who is devoted to it. Guy?
You're saying the definition? Does it glorify God? I mean, is that the truth?
Well, a description, whether in a question form or not, a description of the end in view.
That will this, whatever I do, bring glory to God.
Okay, we have a question here. Other descriptions? Greg?
The end is that the... that the good is accomplished that was needed.
Good is accomplished. Ben?
It's knowing what I've committed my life to, and that is that my whole being is consecrated to doing the greatest amount of good I can with the means and abilities I have.
Doing greatest amount of good, able? Greg?
Please add for some.
And I will add that. While you're at
this is real important. This is good. Think. Keep that thing seized up. Finney gave the illustration of the two students at Oberlin, fictional students, but as an illustration, one student bought books. He had a job so that he could buy books, so he could attend college, so he could be in the ministry, so that he would have a secure future, so he could have a family, so we could be happy. Another young man had a job so he could buy books, so he could attend college, so that he could go into the ministry, so so that he could save souls for the glory of God. Were those the same end in view? Did they use the same means, mostly? Yeah. Same means can be chosen with a different end in the person's mind. So two people may have two different ends, but you observe them and they're using the same means, and it's a temptation to conclude that they are after the same goal, the same end. But they're not. Only the motive matters. In that case, only the motive matters. God knows the motive of the heart. Why? The big question is why. What the law commands and requires, and what God commands, is the why. God does not command, the law does not demand any particular act. It is demanding that the will have the right why, be devoted to the right why. The act of the will in selecting the reason the law commands is what the law is after. Why is the big issue. Selection of the will, commitment of the will to promote, not just let it happen or be happy if it happens, commitment of the will to promote the well-being of another for its own sake. This is obligation. Moral beings are under an obligation to a moral law. That obligation is to promote the well-being of another for its own sake. We all know what the word ground means by now in these discussions. Ground of something in these discussions is the reason or the foundation. Okay? What is the reason or the foundation or the ground of this obligation? Why is someone, a moral being, obligated to promote the good of another for its own sake? Understand the question in those terms? Why is a moral agent, why am I obligated to promote the good of another for its own sake? Greg?
Because God is obligated to?
Is those two answers?
Well, I think of him as having always done that.
That is true. God has always been committed to promote the good of another for its own sake. That's true. Is that the reason I am obligated to? Because he has always done that. He has always done a lot of things that I am naturally impossible for me to do. Okay?
Because you trust and have confidence in him. And because of that, you believe what he commands us to do for our own good. You don't have confidence in the one commanding something, then what good is it?
Am I obligated to promote the good of another for its own sake because I trust God? Does that mean if I don't trust God, I'm not obligated to? See my question? Are unbelievers obligated to be committed to promote the good of another for his own sake, even though they don't trust him? Pat? What does that mean? The value of the good. Anybody? Jeff? Stab away.
The value, in a sense, is nothing for us, or is so minuscule to us personally, but in terms of God's government, the entire kingdom should have great value towards His glory.
Pat says the ground or the reason for why I am obligated to be committed to promoting the good of another for its own sake is the value of the good itself. Tell me what that means, Greg, in your mind is... You've heard that. What does that say? Can you express that back?
What you just said?
Mm-hmm.
The grounds for doing good to another would be because of the value of the good itself.
And that's it? Or is there more?
For its own sake.
Okay. I am obligated, every moral being is obligated to be committed to promoting the good of another for its own sake, for its own sake means that in the good that I am promoting, there is something that's valuable, and I don't need any other that or any other reason to do it other than the good itself. The good to be promoted is the sufficient reason I'm obligated to promote it. That's what it means for its own sake. Can you see that, Greg? See something there? The good to be promoted to another person has value in and of itself. It doesn't have value because it will do something after I have promoted the good. I'm not commanded to promote the good so that something else occurs or something else happens. promoting the good for its own sake does not mean that the good is promoted and accomplished so that people know I did it. But just for its own sake. There is value in the good that I promoted, and it didn't need for people to know it before the value, that good had any value. There was value in the good, so I did it for the sake of the good itself and not for any ulterior motive. For its own sake destroys all ulterior motives. The commitment to promote the well-being of another for its own sake means that you don't even do it to please God. The grounds for this obligation is the value of the good itself, not so that God will see it and be pleased. One who loves according to the spirit of the law promotes the good for its own sake, not so that God will be pleased. Because if that were the case, the good has no value until God is pleased. And if God is pleased, then my good I gave had value to it. Only after God was pleased. Or maybe after I knew He was pleased. Then the good took on value. Greg?
What is Paul saying?
Book are you in?
Well, I'm just trying to think of the verse. I can't find it. Ralph Ham, he says, talking about doing something. Maybe it's all the way in Galatians. If I yet please man. But, you know, we please God, he says.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not doing anything to please man, but God.
Mm-hmm.
So he's using that as a motive. He knows what he's doing, he's pleasing to God.
Let me address that in general. I think I can shed some light on that in a general way. To have as any other end would be transgression of the law. The law commands that I have good for its own sake as the end for which I live. To have any other end is to transgress the law, and that would be called sin. Okay? That would be displeasing to God. The sinner does not have his end to be displeasing to God, but to please himself, which is displeasing to God, but that's not the end he has in view. Follow me, Greg?
Yeah, well, I found the verse.
Okay.
First Thessalonians. It's like chapter 2, verse 4. Not as pleasing men, but God who examines our hearts. God, so we speak not as pleasing men,
mm-hmm.
but God.
Yeah, he didn't have the motive to pleasing men, but he was pleasing God. The point here is, I'm going to give you a general thing to apply in your thinking, and that is, the sinner does not have displeasing God as the end in view. Nevertheless, it is displeasing God.
Right.
One who loves God supremely is seeking the greatest good for God's interest, and that is pleasing to God. But what he has in mind is not pleasing God, but promoting God's interest supremely. Nevertheless, that is pleasing to God.
Aren't those so linked together that they're almost inseparable?
Well, for purposes of discussion, we must purify our understanding about the end in view.
That's pure.
As pure as pure. It has to be purified like that in our thinking. Because if people can work all their life for God with the idea, I'm doing this to please God, and that easily gets turned into, I didn't do so well, so God must not be pleased with me. And they start shifting their thinking into a different framework when the end that they have in view is not the good they can do for His kingdom, but whether it pleases Him. Because the tendency is to start measuring, did this please Him? Did that please Him? Not, was this good for His kingdom? Okay. People go into the ministry. They do not have in view the good that they can do, but they have in view the large church that they can build. Now they may say, this will be good, but they don't have in view the good. They have in view the large church, thinking that that's the will of God, is to get a large church or carried by a lot of people. Just a number of things. They can be moved by the desire to be in the ministry. Now, for its own sake means there's no ulterior motive other than the good itself. A person can say to themselves, I am going to live for God and love Him supremely because I know that's what will make the greatest happiness for me. What do they have in view? Their own happiness. Or, you know, things will go well in my life, or I'll overcome this, or my marriage will work well or something if I live for God. Well, that's the reason that they're doing it, not for the good itself, but for some personal gain. Good only to themselves, and that selfishness, not for the greatest amount of good. Greg and I have several times discussed this and peeled away and discussed what pure motive it is to do something for its own sake. It just leaves you hanging. And you're accustomed all your life to living for an ulterior motive. And then you see the concept that what the law commands is no ulterior motive, but just do it for the good of itself, because good has some value in it. It just leaves you, you know, just, it's a totally different end to live for. Completely. Kim? Puzzle?
I just can't see that.
Okay. Is this your statement? Okay. Okay. If it is a desire to glorify God that one views as the motive that they're to have to love God, then it is just a desire. Okay, follow me?
I don't know if she understands it. The word want is
okay.
An expression of desire.
Is this, in your mind, is this an expression of a desire? The desire to love God? The desire to glorify God? The wanting to? The desire to? Okay. If it's a desire that is what is moving your thinking and is the basis of your activity, then it is a desire. But desires do not move the will. So one can possess the desire to love God. One can possess the desire to promoting the greatest good. But if it only consists in desire, it's like sitting in a car with the engine running, but not in gear. Because desire doesn't move the will.
But when you do an act,
to glorify God, that your chief end is that you want to do that because you know it will bring glory to God when you do something for somebody. That when something done for that, that you want to glorify God, you know that when you do it, it's going to please God. Or it's going to glorify God.
Okay, I understand personally. How I had it worded in my mind was, I have a hard time seeing the sin when I'm trying to please God. Trying to please God is selfish. Doing things to please God is just selfish.
Not to gain my favor with God, but just to please his heart.
Why please his heart?
Because I love him.
Mm-hmm. You're doing it for his sake?
To show your love for him?
Okay. A person who loves God supremely will have as their end the good. One of the most efficient ways to know the good is God's commands. The whole Bible is a revelation of what would be good. Okay? So God's commands reveal to us what would be good. Still, because it reveals to us what would be good, that's why we do it. Because it would be good. If the mind adapts, the end is to please God. And not the good. The command does not say, thou shalt please God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength, and please your neighbor as yourself. It is love God, which means the commitment to promote the greatest good for his interest. For its own sake. Not for any other sake. Now, I'm not one to quibble about words. I'm interested in the idea. If in your mind pleasing God has resulted in the commitment to forsake self as an end and serving God and your neighbor and promoting their good, then you'll have the evidences of no more selfishness and a benevolent heart towards God and towards others. You will know that you've made a commitment away from selfishness and towards promoting the greatest good you can, and one of the ways is obeying God's commands. You must be aware that you've made that commitment in your heart. Okay? What I want to stay away from is saying, okay, you can please God as your end, but that's an isolated case. If the rest of your life is in the struggle with your desires and your feelings, and you know that you're in bondage to those things, then any expression of, I'm doing these things to please God, has some other reason than the spirit of love behind it. See what I'm saying? A person who has made this commitment as their end cannot still be in bondage to desires and feelings. So, if a person is still in bondage to their flesh, that is, their desires and feelings, whatever they may think is going on where they think that they are doing something to please God, it cannot have that as its end. It's impossible to be in bondage to the flesh and love God at the same time. Love God supremely. This may be a desire to do things to please God. Do things to please God. Here's where an important distinction needs to be made. Doing things to please God, or even doing things to promote the good. Okay, even that. Even if we were to say a person does things to please God or does things to promote the good, is different than the will being committed to promoting the good. Because the sinner can do things, externals, acts. The law is not after external things. God is not after external things, doing certain things. What it is after is a commitment for the rest of one's life to promote good for its neighbor, for its own sake, in everything. Not just doing some things. You see the distinction I'm making? Okay. Greg?
What if you see somebody that's really fat and obese, they don't have a thyroid condition or something, and you know they don't have that. Yet they, you know, Christian, love God, and really active serving God as best you can tell. Are you somehow to maybe think that they're deceived because they're so large that they're obviously seeing it in bondage to food, eating so much to get so large, but yet, you know, are we just to kind of just not even try to evaluate something like that or be concerned with it? How do you...
I know what's going on in their life. I don't give my mind energy to make those evaluations. I shared with Pat that of all particular forms of overindulgence, I think that obesity is probably one which is an occasion for me to be tempted to evaluate. But when I do, if I were to evaluate a person and say, well, they must be obese because they're overindulging, because they're selfish, my mind is off of any good I might do them and on upon what I see. So it doesn't really promote their good for me to make those evaluations. And I can do them no good unless I personally know them. If I personally know them, I would talk to them about other things than their obesity. Because you start with symptoms and you will help nobody in any way. You've got to start with the truth of what God requires, God's character, those things. And their own mind and their own conscience will affirm what's true for them and their motives behind what they do.
Kind of the reason I bring that up is because I'm teaching a little Spanish Bible study right now, as you know, Monday night. The lady that's the most knowledgeable of the word that answers most of my questions, you know, rather large, and you know, it's kind of like, do I need to somehow, I'm trying to bring out all the, you know, get to the pure motives of why one loves God and what it means to believe in God, and at some point maybe she's supposed to put together that she's in bondage to food, and therefore not really is living for desires, is in bondage to a desire of the flesh. You know, I get this, a teacher, as I'm wondering, how do I get that message to her?
Just teach the truth.
Let her make that put together.
No different than a person sitting there with a very trim figure. Who has a very trim figure, because they are living according to the desire to look trim.
Sure.
So they're bulimic or whatever because of desire. But you can't tell. So one is prone to zero in on what is apparent indulgences, and direct your remarks that way and become partial in your comment and miss people who may need to hear the whole counsel of God. You don't think? So just teach the truth, and God and their conscience will do the rest. Until an end is seen, no one ever chooses means to accomplish that end. So everybody has an end. Everybody in this world has an end that they live for. They may not think about it very much. It may be lost in their thinking. They may need light before they're even aware of what they live for or that state of it. But everybody has an end. And the end that the gospel and the law calls for is benevolence for its own sake. Just for the sake of the good that others may have. Now, let me just take one more occasion to make a comment on this, the doing of things. Listen real carefully. The law does not command the doing of the good. It commands the will's commitment to promoting the good, whether it is able to or not. The law commands that the heart be committed to promoting the greatest good it can, God supremely and my neighbor as myself. If the heart is devoted to that, it is fulfilling the spirit of the law, or that it has the ability to accomplish good for another person is a separate question. It is whether I am committed and disposed to promoting your good. Whether I can ever get to you to promote your good or not, the law doesn't command that I actually produce it if I am unable to, but it commands that I be disposed to promoting good wherever I live with whomever I can reach. Do you see that distinction? It is that what the law is after is the commitment to promoting good wherever, whenever, with what I have, with my abilities. It is not commanding a certain quantity of good be done per day, per week, per month. But all the good I can promote with where I am, with what I have. It is that commitment to devote all of my being to that end, not the commitment to accomplish a certain quantity of good in my life or in this next month. But that in my living and breathing and eating and drinking, I have one end in view. The greatest good that I can accomplish. And if in eating and my drinking I would stumble my brother by eating meat, I will refrain from that, as Paul says. Because I'm after his good. The predisposition of the heart to promote the greatest good where possible has already decided the issue when it comes to certain cases. It has already decided it will do what is good. And then when it finds itself in a circumstance where this is known to do good or this is known that it won't do good, the decision has already been made to do the good or not hinder the good or whatever. So it's just a matter of understanding where I'm at and what the issues are, and the decision to promote good has already been made. It's not a day-by-day evaluating whether I promote good on this case or not this case. It is a commitment at the time of conversion that from now on I am devoted to one end, promoting the greatest good. Important distinction. It has nothing to do with case-by-case acts. What the law is seeking to do is being written on the heart, that is, the devotion of all my being to promoting the greatest good. Opportunities will avail themselves greatly. But what the law is after, and what God, the gospel is after, is that commitment now to promote the greatest good throughout the rest of my life. Not every day as I go, sitting down and go, now, will I be devoted today? Well, I don't know about today. Tomorrow's a better day. But the decision is made once for all. It's just like you get married. It's done. The decision about some other man or other woman, it's out of the question. It should be. Jeff?
You brought up the eating. It sparked something in my mind in Corinthians 10, 1 Corinthians 10. At the end of the chapter, it talks about nobody should seek his own good but the good of others.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end, talking about the eating, so whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do it all for the glory of God.
Mm-hmm.
It almost sounds like you're making or the promoting of good, giving that a title of God.
Mm-hmm. No, because God is not promoting God. God is devoted to promoting good. And we are to be devoted to the same end. Because that's what the law commands. What God is committed to and what the law commands is the same end. Now, what...
So we're not... the ground for doing this... Yeah, just threw me there. Because it sounded like you're saying the ground for doing this is because God is devoted to promoting the good.
Okay.
Well, if God is, and I can only do it if I trust Him, like Guy was saying. If I don't trust Him a lot, I wouldn't be there anyways. I can only do it if I trust Him. I can only be committed if I trust Him. No other way.
To the sinner who has refused to trust Him and love Him, the only way he will make that commitment, not can, is when he comes to trust in God's character. Then he can. He can, but he won't.
He can be committed to Him if he doesn't trust in Him?
He can be committed to promoting the greatest good. He can be promoted to can be committed to loving God, but he won't. That's the whole argument God has of him. He won't love Him. Not that he can't. So he draws him into confidence to himself, which brings the sinner to be willing to do that which he was unwilling to do before, and that is love God with all of his heart. We've got two different questions going. How does a sinner come to be willing to make that commitment? Through trust. But what does the law demand that that commitment be is love God, that is promote the greatest good. Now when I said God is devoted to that end, I was simply making a statement that the end I described and the end that God has in view is the same. I was trying to make that statement, not trying to make God and good the same thing. That's two separate questions. How does the sinner become willing to make that commitment? It's when he has confidence in God. The fact that he is devoted to something else and does not love God supremely is not because he can't, because he won't. And that's the whole issue between the sinner and God. His unwillingness. There are a lot of ramifications of this that we don't have time for, but explaining God's character in light of this command to show that He is devoted to the greatest good. And that does glorify Him, but that's not what He has in view. Our devotion to promoting the greatest good does glorify Him, but that's not to be the end.
But it's says, do it all for the glory of God.
But what glorifies him? Being righteous or conformed to the law? Yeah, being righteous is conforming to the law. And if one is righteous, that glorifies God. I could express to you what we've been talking about in 10 different ways. But when we're trying to get down to identify the end, I've got to be very specific, even though I could describe it a different way.
So saying, do it all for the glory of God is just another way of describing, do it for the good itself.
Do it in conformity to the law, which glorifies God. Paul would be saying, do it for the glory of God. In other words, do it in God's way, in God's prescribed means, for God's reasons. That's what glorifies God. In other words, if God would give up His Son, give up your eating and drinking, because God gave up His Son and that glorifies Him, but that's not why He did it. He did it for the sake of the sinner. It's some things are true, and other things we put names on them as a way of identifying them, but that's not the thing in itself. You transgress the law, that's called sin. But sin doesn't exist in itself. It's the name of something else. So glorifying God is the name we put upon something. It's not something in itself. Okay, any other last questions before we break it off here? Let your mind exercise these things and understand that what the law commands is a pure motive for its own sake. That loving God cannot have any element of benefit to self if it's a pure motive. Cannot have any ulterior motives. Must be just for its own sake. Because that's what God did too. Okay.